The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I'd like to do a little bit of a follow-up talk from last week. One of the things I mentioned last week is the Buddhist value of having few wishes, being content and fewness of wishes. And I also talked about a place in Buddhist practice of finding a place, a very profound place of absence of desire. And those two teachings by themselves, it's easy to hear them and generalize from them. And when people generalize from Buddhist teachings, what that means is they take teachings that are particular to particular circumstance, context, and then assume they're meant for all of our life. So to say that there's a place of freedom with the absence of desire, freedom from desire, there's no desire at all, it's kind of the goal of Buddhist practice in a sense. But that does not mean that we're supposed to live without any desire at all. And the point of Buddhism is to, you know, that somehow Buddhism is critical of desire and is supposed to come to a place of no desire at all. So I wanted to talk more about desire, partly because of what I talked about last week as a corrective in case it was misunderstood, and partly because I think it's a very profound topic. It's profound because desire, in all its different forms, there's a family of different, you know, ecosystem filled with different species of desires, are really at the heart or central to being human. Human activity, living human life, that without desire, you know, much of what we is meaningful in life and valuable and drives life wouldn't happen at all. And so we have to kind of look at the different kinds of desire, the unwise kinds of desire, desires that bring suffering, the desires which are wise, the desires which benefit us. And but certainly we can appreciate that you know, that desires have a huge role in our life. And maybe it's a little bit petty to bring it up, but most forms of literary and video entertainment, movies and literature, fictions we write, are really centered around someone's desire. Otherwise, it wouldn't be very interesting. Someone, romance desire, romance movies and, you know, and novels in particular, that's real obvious there. But, you know, all kinds of adventures and, you know, criminal movies and, you know, mysteries. If someone has a desire, that's at the heart of it. And we wouldn't be as entertained in this life if there was no desires. We wouldn't be as heartbroken if there weren't people acting on desires, or if we don't have our desires, and our desires are disappointed, or our desires are crushed, our desires are unfulfilled, without desires, we wouldn't have some of the highest reaches of human capacity and human accomplishments. We would not have some of the great movements of compassion and care and expressions of wisdom that go on. Desires are kind of, you know, built into the very fabric of our lives and our hearts and our societies. And to any way convey that we're supposed to have no desires, I kind of suspect that it just means that we'll just have a population of depressed people. And So I evoke this with the idea that one of the really important things to do is to become a student of desire, a student of your desires. And whether it's directly or indirectly, I would like to believe that's partly what Buddhism is. That as we deepen our mindfulness, deepen our concentration, deepen our self-reflection and understanding of what brings suffering and what doesn't, that there's a clarification around our relationship to desires and recognition of all the different forms of desires that are there, and being able to distinguish between craving or lust or clinging desire versus the kind of desires that are behind things like sincerity and commitment, dedication, devotion, beautiful qualities of the heart that people can live their life by and do wonderful things. And to see the difference between those, which are life-giving and which are life-denying or life-destroying, what we're going. So as I go into this talk, I wanted to evoke a very simple idea. So if nothing else, this simple idea stays with you. And then, you know, the rest of the talk is risk-free for me. So the simple idea is that all of Buddhism can be summarized in this simple statement. Whenever any circumstance you're in, don't make it worse. Improve on it. Wherever you're at, don't make it worse. Make it better. That's it. Now good luck. Go to work. And this idea of don't make it worse, I think that's a real wonderful kind of mirror for ourselves, or kind of call to look at ourselves and say, if I'm talking to someone, I'm in some kind of circumstance, am I going to make it worse now with what I say, with what I do, with what I think, what I feel? Am I making this worse for myself by the judgments and criticism and self-criticism that I'm living under? Am I making it worse because I've filled with blame and hostility to others? I spent yesterday one of my yearly visits to the California State Prisons to visit the GRIP program. And these are men who are lifers, many of them who have committed murder. And they're looking very deeply at how they've made things worse. And the lesson yesterday had a lot to do, what came out was they read letters they'd written of the unfinished business of their lives. And there were letters mostly to, all of them, were to relatives that were impactful for them when they were children. And mostly they were horrific things that happened that their parents or mothers or fathers had or brothers had done. And that the deep hurt, abandonment, shame, trauma of what happened to them as kids was the momentum or the behind how they lived a life of making things worse. And so they had to understand the roots of what they were avoiding, what they were trying to shove down, what they were trying to compensate for in order to kind of really kind of come to some deeper place. And then it was clear that they were interested in making things better. And that's why they were there. And there was discussions about how, among some of the facilitators, that in some of the prisons where they have been doing this program, that in the years when they have the program, there's 30, 60, 90 men who go through these programs, that the yard, the prison yard, gets calmer. And when for some reason they haven't been able to go into the prison to do the programs, the next years the tension in the yards go up. So making things better. So this simple idea for your life, any situation you're in, are you going to make it better now, or are you going to make it worse? So the Buddha's way of saying this is much more complicated. And I'll read it to you, but I'm reading it to you not because of how he says it, but what he says about how to do it. And it has to do with having desire and how to participate in certain desires. And it's kind of very, I think, very strong language that usually is not associated with some of the Buddhist teachings that are taught sometimes in the West. But often their teachings are often about acceptance, about not having so caught up in goals, not wanting so much, letting go. And so it can suggest a kind of passive approach to Buddhism, just kind of sit and be open to the experience and just be present. So it's how we do this I want to emphasize, so that otherwise it might get bogged down in there. But there's four statements. The first statement says, if you haven't yet made it worse, don't make it worse. If you're making it worse, stop doing it. If you haven't made it better yet, start doing it. And if you're making it better, keep doing it. So that's the kind of, you know, simple way. So you have to kind of, maybe now you'll hear what I say. But remember, so how is like this. Awaken desire. Awakening desire, one makes effort, arouses energy, strives, and endeavors. I mean, that's strong language. So this is the how, okay? And what, friends, is right effort? Here, a person awakens desire for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states. And one makes effort, arouses energy, strives, and endeavors. One awakens desire for the abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome states. And one makes effort, arouses energy, strives, and endeavors. One awakens desire for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. And one makes effort, arouses energy, strives, and endeavors. One awakens desire for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase, and fulfillment by development of arisen, wholesome states. And one makes effort, arouses energy, strives, and endeavors. This is called right effort. It's exhausting just to read it. So I usually don't teach this very much because it's kind of a little complicated and it just sounds like, wow, we have to really, you know, get to work here and you know, make a lot of effort. And the association people make with effort are often, you know, one of exhaustion and now I got to do work. But I think if you understand the nature of this work really well, it doesn't have to feel like a lot of effort, though sometimes it is. But why I wanted to read this was because of this requires desire. It says here, one awakens desire. And the desire, simplistically, is to don't make it worse. If you're doing a situation, don't make it worse. And a desire to make it better. The highlight is, and then that desire is done with energy, with dedication, with oomph. This is not for the lazy. And in fact, the Buddha was very explicit. He said, what I'm teaching is not for the lazy. And it's to really engage. And it's engaging in a desire. It's a desire which is meant to counter unhealthy desires. There are wise desires that can move us towards freedom, that can move us towards love. There's very profound within us desires. If we kind of quiet down and get really centered and really deep inside, the heart will have desires. It can't not have it. It's the nature of the heart to desire. But that desire, when it gets deep inside, might not feel like it's selfish desires or egotistical desires or it's desires that well up from the control tower of self. You might not even feel like you identify with this as me, the desire that I'm having, but there is desire happening. There's a wanting something to happen. There's motivation. So compassion and loving kindness, goodwill, are motivational. They involve some kind of desire. Can a mother's care for a child, can that arise from something deeper than the egotistical control tower where we identify this is me, myself, and mine? Is it something deeper in our biology, the biology of the heart even, physiology, to to care and to nurture and support. And the idea to nurture and care for something is a desire of sorts. You know, you might not call it a desire in the moment of taking care of a baby. It just seems like a natural thing to do. But it points to how some of these desires don't have to require a lot of self-conscious work. Like now I have to gear up and do here and do all this stuff. It can come from some deeper place. At the same time, there are powerful desires which are unhealthy to act on. And to have a deep respect to the volcanic power of addictions and lust and craving and really wanting things that can exist in people, maybe some of you. Maybe some of you, if you just remember when you were teenagers, the strength of some of those desires were, you know, pretty intense, and your poor parents that had to deal with it. And but some of these drives that we have that sometimes are unhealthy for us, the force and the place where they arise from in us is like, you know, biological. It's like, wow, it's just like, it's very hard to control them. And so how do you, you know, to just say kind of open and accept what's there, you know, watch out. Better not be close to me then. And sometimes to be able to not give in to some of these unhealthy desires takes a tremendous amount of work. It takes a very strong desire to counter it. Some people have to break into a sweat, literally, in order not to give in to unhealthy desires they've given into so many times. And there are people who will say, it's come to be a matter of life and death. The strong addiction, strong push of my desires, unhealthy desires, is killing me, literally. And if I'm going to live, I have to stop. And so there has to be a counter desire that takes a lot of effort. And what the Buddha says here is lightweight compared to what some people have to do in order to really gear themselves up. So there are desires which are unhealthy that take a lot of work to counter, and you have to take them quite seriously. Some people have to have got support and help from others. And it's not easy. And then we have desires which on the far other end are healthy and just seem to arise naturally and easily, and it mostly comes from a lot of relaxation and ease and sitting and just like, of course, this is what happens that goes on. And then there's a whole range of things in between that go on. And to appreciate the complexity of our human desires, all the different aspects, and to maybe start collecting, if you will, all the different desire words we have in English, or if you have a different language in your language. So to go through some of them, I'll try to go from the most unhealthy to the healthiest. Let's see if I can do what I come up with. So there is addiction, craving, lust, clinging, grasping. And then there's maybe just wanting, just, you know, hoping, wanting, longing. There is aspiration, dedication, devotion. There is inspiration. There is, I don't know. That's what I come up with right at the moment. Do you have any other one to contribute some words to the list? Persistence? Yeah, I love persistence. I'm not sure persistence is a desire, but it's needed for desire, maybe, or the desire to persist, the desire to keep going, sustain it. So I think of persistence as my strong, kind of my strong quality that's really supported me in my practice, so I love it. Yes?
Maybe commitment.
Commitment. Yes?
Yearning.
Yearning is in that range. Sorry?
Ambition.
Inspiration.
Passion.
Louder?
Passion.
Passion. That can fit on both sides of the...
vision or dream.
Inner dream?
Dream or a vision.
Dream? A dream, having a dream, a dream, aspiration, dream aspiration. So all these have different flavors and different ways they live in us and different impacts. Now to make this a little more complicated, a person can have appropriate, healthy desires, beautiful desires, but the way that they engage in them is unhealthy. So, for example, there can be a lot of self-referential, egotistical relationship to them. You know, I want to help my neighbor who's sick, but I want all the other neighbors to know it. You know, I want it broadcast to the local newspaper. You know, I want to get all the credit. And, you know, I'm going to make sure that all the neighbors know. I'm going to knock on the door and tell them. You know, so then, you know, certainly began maybe with a wonderful aspiration to help a neighbor, but some of these extra things added on could actually be not only harmful for oneself, but a burden for everyone else has to live with it. There can be a lot of expectation that we're going to succeed, and we have the complicated idea of success and what it means. So if I don't succeed in this desire, that means something terrible about the world, about me, or something. And so we add this burden of association, what it means, you know, desire. So there's a whole slew of things that come along with the healthy desire that actually makes the whole the complex unhealthy. And so part of this investigation and discovery of how the ecology of desire is not only to understand the nature of our desire, where it comes from inside of us, but also discover how we live with our desires, how we act on them. Some people have really profound desires, things that are really important for them, that arise up, but they're afraid, and they never follow through on them. Or they feel like they're not worthy of it. Who am I to do that? Who am I to want that? And so they hold it in check, and then it never comes out. And so to really understand all the ways we relate to desire. So then we come to the goal of Buddhist practice and how this can help with a healthy relationship with desire. Buddhist practice is ultimately, in a certain kind of way of understanding ultimate, come to an experience with a radical absence of desire. All desire, both healthy desires and unhealthy desires. That's refreshing. Just as maybe, I don't know if it's a fair example, is that a person might have all kinds of important desire to help the world. And they're going to go train for a long time and get a professional training in this career. They're going to engage in that career. And following through on this desire is like their heart's greatest wish. From time to time, they better take a vacation and really put that aside and not have that desire churning and going and really rest the mind in a deep way. Get refreshed and clear out and then come back and pick the desire up again when it's time to go back to work, for example. So in Buddhist practice, we practice Buddhism. The goal, if you're following the path all the way, is to come to a quieting of the mind where we feel complete, contented, and free with a mind that has no desire. Where we feel at ease in this world. So the neurosis of feeling I'm inadequate, or feeling I have to prove myself, or I have to defend myself, or I have to get what I want, or I have to do this and that, all the different kind of neurotic ways in which that can play itself out, has been put to rest, and we experience the phenomenal goodness, the phenomenal freedom of sitting, of being present in this world with radical uprooting of all desire. Not only the desires that we're consciously, normally consciously aware of, but the deeper structures of the heart, deeper structures of it all, that have to do with the desire to live, the desire to be alive, the desire to, you know, the deepest desires that a human being has that kind of underlie all the others. And to even discover what those are, it takes quite a while in doing Buddhist practice, but then to really put them to rest. And we're not to expect it then to put them to rest forever, but if we know a freedom, if we know a sense of wellness, that it's possible to be alive, free, happy, without desire. Then when the time for desires again, we relate to the desires in a very different way. They become simpler, because the neurotic way of being involved or the egotistical ways of being involved are less likely to be there. When the desires start coming back again, we have much more ability to see what's going on and to choose between the healthy ones and the unhealthy ones. And we're much less likely to be pushed. The pressure of our desires is actually going to push us. We still have desires. We might have some still healthy and unhealthy desires. But we're not free, I'm not sure how to do this in English. We're not free from desires. We're free of desires. Is that right? Or maybe it's vice versa. It's not the freedom that's the absence of desires, but it's the freedom that when desires arise, we're not caught in them. We can see them arise. We have the ability to choose. Okay, this one I'm not going to act on. This one I'm going to act on. And so to have that ability and that a certain kind of power of choice like that, it really helps to have put to rest, to have stopped all desire. And it's a high bar. I appreciate that, the Buddhism has. But even going part way provides a lot of freedom. Even any degree to which we learn to put to rest our desires and feel a goodness of that will give us some perspective and distance and freedom to be able to choose how we relate to some desires when they come up again. And the deeper we can do this, the deeper we can come into a place of no desire, then, I think the more power we'll have when we come out of it in terms of choice and ability and know how to go forward. It's also a way of clearing out. It's like a spiritual vacation or something, a vacation of the heart to really clear out really, really deeply. And there has to be this clarity that comes from this ending of desire. Allows the desires that do arise to arise in a simpler way. And to arise in not only a simpler and more clarity and all those not all complicated associated things we do with them, but also to arise without needing to feel that it's me having the desire. That it seems to arise from someplace, I like to say, someplace deeper than who I am. What do you think of that? That which is deeper inside of you than who you are. Isn't that great? I like that at least. But if you don't like that, then you could say, well, the desire came from something bigger, you know, beyond me. Who knows? Inside, deep, outside. It's all good. But not from this little, you know, me or the control tower. It's so neurotic. And so this clearing out of no desires and seeing this deeper thing arise, and then to have the ability to be wiser about how we engage in them, to have passionate desire, but no expectation of success, to have a passionate desire and no need to prove oneself in following through on those desires, to have, even to organize your whole life around a particular desire. It's so important for you. Like that's the organizing principle of your life. And feel like it's a completely natural movement that you're dedicated to, committed to. But whether you succeed or not, or whether how good you are at it or not, that's incidental to deciding, yes, this is what I want my life to be about. So, having fewness of wishes to be content is part of the support for coming to a place of looking at our desires in a deep, deep way, and doing an inventory and a cleaning out and a rectifying of them. Coming to a place where there's no desire, however temporary it is a phenomenal shift of perspective so we can see our desires in a new way. And being able to see our desires in a new way, I hope, allows us to see deep inside of us and appreciate the tremendous depth or tremendous kind of integral kind of working of the heart, where there are desires, there are things that are very important for us, or important for the heart, or important for this universe to come together. And what is it in there that's really important? If we settle and open, discover what the heart's wishes are, discover what's, you know, really what's moving us underneath our fears, underneath our preoccupations, underneath our distractions, underneath our you know, maybe superficial desires that we keep ourselves entertained with and soothed by and comforted by. If we really kind of sit still and deep and listen and understand some of the depth of what's going on, what's there? And to make it more interesting, I think, the unhealthy desires we have, the unwise ones, the ones that maybe cause a lot of suffering, it's an interesting, I think it's very useful to maybe assume that they are unhealthy ways to try to attain or accomplish a healthy desire. That deep inside, we have a healthy desire that somehow doesn't play itself out or has been squashed or perverted or hurt in some way. And so it comes out in these unhealthy ways. And I saw that yesterday in the prison. The heartbreaking stories of wanting a mother's love, or loving one's siblings, and wanting to take care of them, and then having horrible circumstances make it impossible and squashed, and that pain of that loss then playing itself out for decades in unhealthy desires wanting to do this and that, and then finally being able to come back and touch the core source where it all began. Desire for love, to be loved and to love, to care. And so the point being that if you happen to have occasionally some unwise desires, rather than dismissing them or feeling bad about them being there or be critical, I shouldn't be this way, one of the powers of mindfulness is to sit with it, listen to it, get to know it well, give it time, but in the safe kind of environment of sitting still, so you're not likely to act on it. And then see if you can find it through the cracks of it. Maybe there's something deeper still, a deeper desire, a forgotten desire, a repressed, oppressed desire, something actually that it's tender and beautiful and maybe more yourself, or coming from a deeper place of who you are, that's been long since overgrown with the weeds of craving and lust and blame and hate. So what's down there deep? So the art of mindfulness is to turn towards all these desires that might be there. So to step towards them, step into them, but don't believe them automatically and don't act on them. But study them, look at them, be with them, learn about them, write letters about all the unfinished business around these things. Discover what's there. And you'll probably become more filled with what's most essential about who you are. You'll tap into kind of the roots, the depths of who you are as a human being, and your gifts, your hopes, your wishes, your desires, that really are those that are worth being the foundation of a life. And from a Buddhist perspective, one of the core central desires is the desire to be free from the grip of desire. The desire to come to the end of desire. And if you let go of that desire to be free of desire, to come to the end of desire, too soon, you'll shortchange yourself. Keep the desires as long as you have a sense that they're useful, and then when they're not useful, put them down. And so when you come to meditate, for example, maybe there's a strong desire that gets you to the meditation cushion. But once you're sitting on your meditation seat, you can give up the desire to get to your seat. Don't keep thinking, I need to get to my seat. And once as you meditate and go deeper, there can be desires there to go, to become freer and freer. But then watch and recognize when it's time to let go of that too, because it's no longer needed. And then coming to a place of freedom. So the desire for freedom, I think, is one of the deep biological urges that is deep in our hearts. And if you sit quietly enough, you'll feel that desire. So those are my words. So hopefully that was a nice corrective from last week. I don't know if I have to do a corrective now for this one. but we're going to have tea today, and I think this is a great day. We have 5 minutes before the usual end of the talk. If you'd be willing to turn to one or two people next to you, say hello, and if you want to offer to your now new friends one little idea that was evoked to you about desire, was meaningful for you in the talk, or evoked in you, or some wisdom you have around desire. But it has to be very brief. Don't give them, I was the only one who was allowed to talk this long today. So make it brief, but just to kind of connect and share and let this talk kind of live in you a little bit longer. And then in those 5 minutes, while you're saying hello to each other, some people will set up the tea, and then everyone's welcome to stay afterwards and chat and talk. Thank you.